You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll visit the one-of-a-kind Angel Museum in Beloit and find out why Oprah Winfrey's angel collection ended up here in Wisconsin.
First, you may be familiar with controversy over the rise in the cost of EpiPens, the life-saving medicine that counteracts severe allergic reactions that most children with allergies are required to have. A joint investigation from WPR, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, and Wisconsin Health News found that the EpiPen isn't the only essential medication that is become unaffordable.
The report found that prices for widely prescribed medications have grown by up to over 5,000% over the last few years. Sean Kirkby was the lead reporter on the story, writes for Wisconsin Health News. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Dee Hall is the managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She contributed to the report. Dee, welcome back to the show, I should say.
All right, thanks a lot.
Well, Sean, let's talk about what's driving these increases in costs, and not, you'd expect maybe a flashy new researched drug that just came on the market that might cost a lot. We're talking about old drugs that used to be really cheap. What happened?
Well, what we're seeing is that some of the companies that have had these longstanding low-cost drugs are stopping making them, and other companies are sort of gaining a monopoly over the market, which is part of the reason for why some of these increases are happening. And there are other reasons, too, that we're seeing more spending on medications. Some of that's in part because there have been pharmaceutical companies that have taken action to extend patent protections on their products, which block cheaper generic versions from being developed. And as you mentioned, there are companies that are introducing more high-cost specialty drugs, like Sovaldi, which is a drug used to treat hepatitis C, and reportedly carries a treatment for the whole entire course of about $84,000.
Dee, can you give a sense of the range of drugs that maybe a decade ago would have been really cheap, and now commonly prescribed medications more expensive, EpiPens and what else?
Well, we saw that insulin went up just 81% in just since 2011. So that's a huge price increase. Insulin is one of those for which there are not generics, so people must buy the brand names. But even when we examined brand name drugs, we found extraordinary price increases. And the main example that I'll cite is doxycycline, which is a common antibiotic. It's used to treat a bunch of different kinds of infections. That went up by 5,200% between 2011 and 2015. And it had actually gone up by over 12,000% at some point back in 2013. So it went from being 4 cents a pill to over $2 a pill. And that's a generic.
And we've heard from, we talked to a doctor a while back who studies this sort of thing, and he had patients who, when they moved, had to locate near a Walmart because they had the cheapest insulin as these prices were going up. You looked some at the consumer impact of drug price increases in general. What kind of things are you hearing for people? We'll get into different kinds of payment, but let's start with people who are paying out of pocket for these medications, Sean.
So we're seeing a lot of people struggling to cover those costs. We talked with one doctor who basically said that, you know, some families are having to ration their insulin, or some patients have to ration their insulin rather than because they can't afford the high prices anymore.
Right, and insulin, not a medication that you're supposed to take a consistent dose all the time. So up and down insulin use isn't really how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, exactly.
And more broadly, we found there was a poll in September. Kaiser Health Foundation or Family Foundation found that 55% of Americans now take some kind of prescription drugs. And the total number who cannot afford that anymore is about 14% of all Americans are saying they are having a hard time now affording medication. And of course, that's even worse for the more than 5% of Wisconsin residents who have no insurance whatsoever. They have to pay for these really high cost drugs out of pocket.
Right. So there we're not talking about a copay or anything like that. That's the entire cost of the medication.
No. And, you know, of course, they lack the kind of clout to negotiate prices that large insurers might have. They're simply on their own to try to figure out how to pay for these. And there are some programs for lowering the cost of drugs or getting free drugs, but those really serve only a very tiny fraction of people who need them.
And so that's individuals who pay. How about government programs, Medicare, Medicaid, that will provide prescription coverage? How much are taxpayers on the hook for, Sean?
So there have been, you know, year after year increases in these types of prices. Now the spending of health care spending on drugs accounts for about 16% 0.7% of the total healthcare spending, or about $457 billion. In Wisconsin, the Medicaid program spent about $330 million a few years ago on prescription drugs. That's now grown to about $427 million by July 1st of this last year. That can vary year to year because of rebates that the state gets from drug manufacturers, but that's about a 30% increase.
As I understand it, Dee mentioned negotiations by insurance companies with drug providers. Medicaid can't do that. Medicaid currently cannot negotiate with drug companies. Is that right, Dee?
I think it's Medicare that cannot negotiate. Okay. And that's, of course, one of our largest health providers, if not the largest health insurance plan that there is. So that's another reason why this is hitting the taxpayers really hard, is because this is a monster program that serves millions of people, and it cannot negotiate for the prices of prescription drugs.
Talking to Sean Kirkby and Dee Hall, they were part of this report on the rising cost of many key prescription medications, how it's affecting people here in Wisconsin. Sean is with Wisconsin Health News, Dee with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Did you talk to people, Sean, looking at possible solutions, legislative or otherwise? What kind of things are out there?
So in Wisconsin, we spoke with Representative Deborah Colste, who is a Democrat from Janesville, who's looking at a price transparency initiative to show how much the state is basically spending on these prescription drugs and to help direct state departments to develop a strategy to control costs. She's also looking at a proposal that would allow emergency medical technicians and first responders to use a vial and syringe for delivering epinephrine into the system rather than an EpiPen, which is used to treat severe allergic reactions, with EpiPens now costing about $600. At the federal level, one of our senators, Senator Tammy Baldwin, has worked with Senator John McCain of Arizona to introduce a bill that would have drug companies justify price increases of 10% or more. So there's a lot of work on transparency efforts going on to try to get a better handle on what's leading to these drug increases, price increases, and what we can sort of do to control that.
And I'd like to add, there's a lot of other activity around the issue of price increases for prescription drugs. There have been numerous congressional hearings where drug company presidents have been pulled in and questioned about why the drugs are going up so much. We've also had other initiatives. For example, in California, there was a price control initiative, and it failed. But the drug companies spent about $100 million in lobbying to defeat that referendum. So we did talk to, in fact, I think Sean talked to some health policy experts, and they feel like this is an issue that's not going away. It's actually gaining traction right now.
And Sean, in this report, we hear the voices of people from the drug industry itself. What do drug companies and their representative organizations say about these price increases that have gotten so much attention?
They point towards a slowdown in the approval process of drugs at the Food and Drug Administration as a possible reason which approves the drugs. They're not big fans of some of these proposals that are coming forward. They think that, for instance, the drug pricing initiative introduced by Baldwin and McCain should focus more on things that would affect how consumers are paying for drugs, such as, looking at out-of-pocket cost.
And Dee, is there a thought that maybe competition will kick in here? Now that I'm company A, I'm the only one who makes this medication. Now that company B dropped out, I crank up the price 500%, 1,000%, whatever. In theory, that'll bring somebody else back into the market to undercut me. Is that maybe a solution?
That's the theory, but some of these drugs do actually have some competition. And what's going on right now, for example, with the various insulin makers, is the federal government, I believe, has launched an investigation, but they're looking into possible collusion by the insulin companies, whether they're raising their prices sort of in lockstep, whether that in fact is happening. So the idea that more competition would help is a good idea, but I think a lot of economists have looked at at the healthcare market and said it's not a true free market in the sense of in many senses.
And as I understand it, another company was going to get into EpiPen or the equivalent thereof. They had trouble with approval. They weren't getting it to work quite right. So it's not as easy as I'm going to go into business tomorrow and make a rival generic drug.
Yeah, and I believe that that company is actually looking at launching that product again sometime next year, I believe.
But there was a recall. So they were in the business. They went out of the business. That appears to possibly have been tied to the price increases of EpiPen, and now they're talking about getting back in. But yeah, competition, it doesn't always work when it comes to prescription drugs and lowering their cost.
And you mentioned an expert from the Kaiser Family Foundation, Sean. That expert had said there's never been this much interest in prescription drug prices before. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing more and more people, consumers, and maybe policymakers taking an interest in this issue?
We've had a number of congressional hearings, specifically, at least recently, around EpiPen and that price increase. There's a lot of people who are upset about this and the large increases that are happening.
Yeah, so and even like Republicans are getting involved to some extent. Our attorney general is sued now over the price of, I believe it is, Narcan?
He sued over the price of Suboxone.
Suboxone,
which
right.
is, it treats opioid addiction. Basically, he's alleging, along with about 30 other states, that there was a collusion between the makers of this drug to change the product and protect its patent rather than allowing it to go off patent and have other medications come on the market that are generic to lower that price.
To compete with it, yeah.
And is that a common practice? Is that part of the price story that I'm making my medication, I tweak it, maybe the delivery, maybe the form of it a little, and then I can keep my patent for longer and keep other drugs off the market?
Yeah, there's a few companies that have done that. There are other companies that when they do go in and they do adjust the product, it's usually to also make it safer.
Well, thanks to both of you so much for joining us today.
All right, thanks a lot for having us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Sean Kirkby and Dee Hall with the Wisconsin Health News and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, respectively. They joined us to talk about a joint investigation they worked on that found that the cost of commonly prescribed drugs have skyrocketed in recent years. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we look at the retail industry and find out why a sector with low wages and irregular hours has also seen low rates of unionization.
Now, about 40 years ago, Joyce and Lowell Berg made the first step toward a unique world record collection. They bought their first angel figurine. That purchase was the first step toward a collection of over 13,000 angels.
That collection found a home in Beloit, and now the Angel Museum is recognized as the largest collection of angels in the world, and it's home of a unique set of angels provided by Oprah Winfrey.
Joyce Berg joins us now. She and her late husband Lowell started the Berg Angel Collection. She's the creator of the Angel Museum in Beloit. Joyce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, hello. Hello, everyone.
How, Joyce, did you and your late husband get started collecting angels?
Well, it was something that happened. We were on a vacation in Florida and just happened to purchase a couple of angels in an antique store. And that led to the next trip that we kind of went on. And we thought, well, let's get angels for souvenirs. So it very soon became a passion. And whenever we traveled, then that's what we looked for, were angels. And it is over 14,000.
14,000 now.
Yes.
Now, how did you end up? You ended up with, you know, you had thousands of angels. How did it go from a display at home, I guess, to becoming the Angel Museum in Beloit?
Well, yes. We would take people through our home, small groups and things like that. Then one day we got a call from a nearby Chamber of Commerce, and they wanted to bring a bus tour. Well, you don't want to take a bus tour through your home. And we realized we needed to share with more people than we could just take through our home. So we started looking for some place to put the angels. And turned out, of course, an old church would be the ideal place. And there just happened to be an old church scheduled for demolition here in Beloit, the former St. Paul Catholic Church. And the parishioners were hoping to save the building. So we all came together, and long story short, the angel saved the church.
I was able to visit you down there, and it is the perfect perfect location for that. But when you first went into this church that was slated to be demolished, what did it look like? What was going on there?
Well, the first time that my husband and I walked in to the building, it was being used by Beloit College for storage. And what struck me is when we walked in, there were mattresses piled high here and there, and some electrical fixtures and things like that. So we had to really visualize what it could look like.
Well, now it's the Angel Museum. And take us through the front door. When we walk in now, we're not going to see mattresses. What do we see when we walk into the Angel Museum?
Oh, you will see cases with thousands of angels. And when people walk through that front door, we get all kinds of reactions, but it's like their breath is just taken away. Wow, this is beautiful. And we have, of course, lovely music playing, and we have some wonderful ladies that give tours and so forth. We have a mural on our back wall that you can see from the front door, and that was especially painted for us. It's called Heritage Angels.
We're talking to Joyce Berg. She's an angel collector, founder of the Angel Museum in Beloit. And Joyce, you've got angels from all over the world. Turns out a lot of different countries are specialized in angels. But you have this unique collection of black angels thanks to Oprah Winfrey. Can you tell us the story of how they found their way to Beloit?
Well, this project was in the mid-90s, and we opened May 1st of 98. The beginning of that particular year, Oprah had Cher on her show one day, and they were discussing angels. Oprah made the comment, "I don't see black angels." Well, of course, her fans started sending them to her right away. And not too long after that, she had to say on her program, "Please don't send me any more. I have no place to put them. They're being stored at Harpo Studios." So some of our board members got in touch with her people and said if she would care to donate them, why, we would be delighted, of course, to take care for them. So that's what happened.
So you have the world's largest collection of angels. It's a Guinness World Record, I think. And probably you must have the largest collection of black angels because, as Oprah said, you don't see those everywhere.
Well, probably we do have the larger collection in one place, perhaps. You know, there might be, I'm not real sure about what the black angel collection would be other places. But we're all there together.
Now, Christmas, obviously, coming up, I imagine that's a big time of year for the Angel Museum. What kind of displays, what kind of exhibit do you have up for Christmas?
Well, this year we have an exhibit of over two dozen different tree toppers. They are various sizes, and some are lighted, some are automated, like their wings will move and so on and so forth. Then we have our tree up there in the I call it the arch area, and we always feature our lovely life-size angel.
And is that out only for Christmas?
No,
that's always out there.
She's in all of our exhibits, and she does more than double duty.
And I wanted to mention, you showed me your late husband, Lowell, still has a presence there in the form of a figurine of him. Can you tell us about that?
Okay. Well, we have what we call the backlighted case, which features all of our stained glass and crystal pieces. And it wasn't there in the beginning. We asked for a case like this to be built, and it didn't happen until after he had passed away, and he would always say, I wish they'd get that backlighted case. So I chose to put a little, I found a figure of a seated man, and a friend made wings and halo for him. And he's sitting there in his chair, and he has a cup of coffee with ice cream, because he didn't like hot coffee. And he has a crossword puzzle book, which he enjoyed, and a stamp collection sitting on a little tiny table next to him, and a very small deck of cards, because he loved to play cards of any kind.
So when I look up Beloit now, Joyce, the Angel Museum always pops up as a must visit. Are you getting a lot of people coming through there? And now you can take those bus tours that you couldn't take in your house.
We can take bus tours. We'll take all kinds of bus tours. We are. How about I give you the hours?
Sure.
Thursday through Saturday, 10 to 4. We are closed January through March, and we're handicapped accessible, and there is an admission. And we have a wonderful gift shop in our lower level. So there's a lot to see, and if groups of 10 or more would like to come, not being on a bus, you know, if they would call ahead, then we would make arrangements, and they could have a docent give them a tour.
And Joyce, I want to ask just briefly before we let you go, is there an angel that you still wish you had in the collection?
Oh, dear. Well, I'll tell you, I still haven't seemed to quite acquire a Green Bay Packer angel. I've had different people come in, and I've said this, you know, oh, I'll make you one and send it. But it's never come through.
Uh-oh. Well, there's got to be a craftsperson out there listening
there
who can maybe help you out. Joyce, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're so welcome, and thank you.
That's Joyce Berg. She is with the Angel Museum, one of a kind, in Beloit.
Coming up, retail workers often face low wages and unpredictable hours. We find out why the industry still sees low levels of unionization and why, according to our guest. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. This week's theme is rose-colored glasses. Some people go through life with a smile on their faces. Do they know something we don't? Find out tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
There's tremendous power in giving. When writer Crystal Chan was the beneficiary of kindness in an unlikely place, Chicago traffic, she found a way to repay that kindness by giving to someone else.
One day, I was driving in Chicago and was horribly lost. I had no smartphone, no map, and was on the south side of the city. There was nowhere to ask for directions. It was the beginning of rush hour, and I was desperate. I came to a stop at a thick intersection. 5 lanes of cars were all stopped at the red light. I rolled down my window. "Excuse me," I shouted to the lady in the car next to me. She suspiciously rolled down her window. "How do I get to Highway 55? She gave me a look. "Highway 55? You're going in the opposite direction." As she gave me directions, the light turned green, and the long trail of cars crawled forward. I knew I was going to lose her, my lifeline. "I'll pull my car in front of you. Follow behind me," she shouted. "I'll drive you there." My jaw fell open. I'd had people give me directions before, but never, ever had anyone been so kind as to actually drive me there. But she did. She drove me over 10 miles through rush hour traffic to help a stranger get to the right highway. She was Black. I am not. That didn't make a difference. The only thing that mattered was the kindness of the heart. I was utterly floored and frustrated. I could never repay her for her kindness. So that day, I decided that I would pay it forward. And an image popped into my mind of a group of teenagers at a restaurant. Not one teenager, not two, it had to be a group, and I decided I would pay their bill. I wasn't sure when that would happen, but I was on the lookout. 2 months later, my mom and I were driving to Oshkosh on Highway 45. We stopped for breakfast in West Bend, and in the booth right behind us was a table of five teenagers. This is it, I thought. This is my opportunity. I flagged down their waitress and asked for their bill. The teens were talking and didn't notice anything. About 15 minutes later, their table got eerily quiet, and all five of them were peering around. Who was it? One of the girls caught my eye, and I told them it was me. The five of them stared. "Why did you do that?" one asked. And I told them the story of my angel on the highway, of the woman who helped me out and her ridiculous kindness. Those teens listened, wide-eyed, their hearts open. The waitress stood next to me, listening to the story. After they left, the waitress came up to me and said, "That was really nice what you did. I know those kids. They're really rough, get into trouble a lot. I don't know how you knew, but that was the perfect table for you to choose to do that to. The perfect story to tell." My mom's eyes welled with tears, and so did mine. It was one of those rare moments that you get a glimpse of something bigger, some interconnectedness that is so much more intertwined than you could ever imagine. As we were leaving, my mom told me she'd overheard one of the boys say to another, "Great, now I'm going to have to be nice to someone."
Crystal Chan is a storyteller and the author of the book Bird. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
We're just a day away from December and the thick of the holiday season, and you might already be gearing up for gift shopping trips at department stores like Macy's or JCPenney. But behind the decorations and that holiday cheer at your favorite retail stores are ongoing questions about the employees who work there. From the irregular hours to low wages, retail jobs are often considered less than desirable.
In the past, some employees in the service sector, even the food industry, have looked toward unions to help improve their pay, benefits, and working conditions. The retail industry showed some involvement in recent strikes for a $15 minimum wage. But despite having frustrated workers, the industry has often had low union membership compared to some other sectors. Our next guest wrote a book that explores an industry that almost all of us have some connection with and also looks at what the future might be for its employees looking for changes.
Peter Eichler joins us now. He's an assistant professor of sociology at State University of New York College at Old Westbury, and his new book is called Hard Sell: Work and Resistance in Retail Chains. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, Peter, you write that retail is well known as a bad job in 21st century America. What is it that makes retail a bad job, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of factors that can go into what people will determine as a good job or a bad job. Some of them more objective, some of them more subjective. But I would say one of the defining features of retail in America today is that its average wages are way below the private sector mean. They're only about 63% currently. And it has much higher levels of part-time work, involuntary especially, as well as fluctuating schedules, which can wreak real havoc on workers' personal lives, family lives, and attempts in many cases to hold second jobs, which is needed based on the low income. So those factors together contribute to making the retail sector, so although there are some good jobs in it, overwhelmingly a negative area for employment for a lot of folks.
And you wanted to find out what was going on in this retail sector, why it wasn't an easier sell to get unions involved here and get the employees on board with looking at unions as a tool to improve working conditions. You looked specifically at Macy's and Target and Walmart. Why did you choose those stores?
Well, I looked directly mainly at Macy's and Target, although obviously with a lot of reference to Walmart because that's the biggest firm in the country that we all know so much about as a retailer. But I focus on Macy's and Target specifically because Macy's is indicative of the sort of old school traditional department store that maybe we're familiar with from images or nostalgia we have from the 50s or 60s, but it's the dominant traditional retailer today. And Target is the sort of second tier after Walmart, large discounter across the country. It represents sort of the new wave of scaled-down retail with scaled-down benefits for workers, but also it's now slowly being displaced to a certain extent by the online retailers, Amazon first and foremost, but other ones as well.
And one of the things you did was you tried to get the lay of the land. You talked to employees about what it was like to work there, what the management style was like, what the hours was like, how they were doing on pay. And what did people tell you?
People told me a lot of things. I mean, I was actually shocked at just the degree of openness that a lot of these workers had to talk to them. I was a grad student at the time. I was nobody to them. New York is a busy place. People have a lot of things going on in their lives. But, you know, 75 people spent time, you know, were able to take an hour, sit down with me in a coffee shop, in a park, in a place that they felt comfortable with, and just explain to me the day-to-day details of their working lives and how they felt about the coworkers, their managers, and society at large. And the things that they told me, that what I tried to piece together out of, you know, the varying views and experiences that workers had, was that if you look at the two stores, the two models, traditional and discount retail, we can definitely see a trend towards de-skilling between them.
And what do you mean by de-skilling?
De-skilling. So employers historically, in the manufacturing sector, as we know, have taken what used to be craft work, you know, which is relatively skilled, where the workers were trained, knew what they had to do, controlled their own pace of work, et cetera, and they put that under increasingly more control, meaning they separated out the labor process, little bits and little pieces, having many workers do little segmented parts with less autonomy to do them. And that's fairly well established for, you know, auto manufacturing, steel, textiles, et cetera. What I argue is that a very similar process is taking place in the retail sector today. And its ultimate sort of end goal would ultimately be full automation, which we're already seeing in the online model.
And besides the de-skilling, what did they say about how much money they were making, whether they were able to get by, and I guess if they thought that these were good jobs that they could make a living on?
Not much, yeah. Most people didn't make much money. The average wages at the Macy's stores I looked at were in the neighborhood of about $11.50 per hour, and at Target a bit lower, about $10.50 per hour. Which is really not much at all in New York City, where most living wage estimates require you, if you have a family of four, to make at least $22 an hour. So we're talking about folks who are, many of them are young, in college, although not all of them, who are making very little money, not enough to live on, and are sort of planning for other things. You know, they see it as a stepping stone. This is just something I'm doing while I'm in college. I'm going to move on to something else. But there's a large number of folks, including those I spoke to, for whom that's it. You know, they don't have a college degree. They don't have some other connection to the labor market, training or credentials, and they have to make ends meet on that, and it's really, really difficult for a lot of people. And they search around for benefits. There are benefits offered at the two firms, but they're often far too expensive in terms of health care for the workers to actually afford. So it's putting workers in a really tough spot, and that's sort of the inroad that I explore to why we need and how we could actually go about getting unionization in a broader sense.
So your sense then, hearing all this, is that these are places, stores maybe like Macy's and Target, but lots of other retail establishments too. These are places that should be sort of ripe for unions to come in and organize. But at the end of the day, that's not what you saw. You saw, in fact, that that was the opposite. How come?
Well, I mean, the opposite is just sort of, we already know that at the outset, right? We know that retail is less than 5% unionized today. It's basically negligible in the sector. And a lot of workers I spoke to were actually open to unionization, were curious about it, were interested in it. A lot of the younger workers simply didn't know what it was. I had to actually explain several times, I was like, so how do you feel about unions? How do you feel about worker organization? And a lot of them, the younger workers especially, under 30, didn't actually know what I meant. Had never had any experience with unions. What some people mistakenly thought that Target did have a union because they thought it meant something other than what it is. So I think there's a potential openness there. But there's huge both objective and subjective hurdles. So it's really hard to, if you put a strike at one store, it's one store, especially in these chain retailers, that have many of the locations, you're at the end of a supply chain. So you don't have a lot of power there as a worker to pull a strike action to, you know, push for recognition of a union. On the other hand, too, we have these subjective hurdles like that, like I mentioned. Folks just, a whole generation that has not seen, you know, what unions can do when they're robust and when they're moving forward rather than when they're just on the defensive, which unfortunately has been the case in Wisconsin, I know, since at least 2011, possibly earlier.
We're talking with Peter Eichler right now, assistant professor of sociology and the author of the book Hard Sell, Work and Resistance in Retail Chains. And we're looking at the low levels of unionization in retail work, despite what our guest sees as complaints of low wages and more within that industry.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in one of these retail stores? Have you worked in them in the past? What was it like? Did you see it as a bad job, or did you see an upside? Did you work for a retailer, maybe one we haven't talked about, that you think does things better or maybe worse? Do you manage in retail or own a retail business? Love to hear your perspective as well. And are unions needed in retail stores? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with Peter Eichler, assistant professor of sociology and the author of the book Hard Sell, Work and Resistance in Retail Chains. And we're talking about the retail industry in this holiday shopping season. Our guest says that's an industry where employees are paid less than in other sectors, but there are still low rates of union membership.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you work or have ever worked in the retail sector. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us about the ups and downs of the job. If you've been in it for a while, how has it changed over the years? And would you join a retail union if given the opportunity? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Peter, we'll get to our calls in just a moment, but I want to ask you, there is a sense that unions at this particular point in history are in decline. I mean, Wisconsin is a case in that point. And is it possible that people in other industries like the retail industry may see that and say, you know, this is not something I want to be involved in. They're not effective and they may be on the way out.
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I appreciate it. I would say that, you know, the objective situation, and we saw this with the really surprise election of Donald Trump back in November, which I think most of us are still sort of trying to digest and make sense of. One of the explanations that has come out of that is that the persistent low level of well-being, stagnation in wages, stagnation in living standards for a large sector of working people in America. And that's not going away. That's been a rather common development and deepening development in the past 30 to 40 years, a period that a lot of people call neoliberalism, globalization, et cetera. So the objective factors that are pushing people to need something different, to try and challenge the existing workplace regimes that they face, be they in retail or elsewhere, one of the answers that workers will end up coming to sooner or later is the idea of collective organization and collective bargaining in some fashion. But I agree, there's been a lot of negative press about unions. There's been a lot of actually negative developments with unions being pushed back, not only in Wisconsin, but also in Michigan, which went right to work. And then just the general slow, steady decline of unionization rates across the country, which has been in action since at least the 70s. So there's definitely objective hurdles there, and there's a layer of folks who might be looking and hearing the news and saying, unions are being pushed back, why would I want to join one? But then the next day, they get up and they go to work, and they're not making the wages that can pay rent at the end of the day, or can afford enough food, and they're constantly scraping by, or they're having to deal with petty indignities at work, you know, being yelled at by a manager or having their daily rhythms micromanaged. All of these things generate dissatisfaction, and I found that among a lot of the workers that I spoke to. And one of the positive aspects, in addition to the developing nature of the Fight for 15 movement, which just had a large demonstration and a couple of walkouts in key places across the country just yesterday, one of the key rooms for hope is that some of the new firms, like Target, relatively new firms, are creating processes that engender solidarity among workers. They collectivize the work process. They use a team-based sales metric instead of a competitive one, like at Macy's and some other firms. And this actually, among the workers I spoke to, generates a sense of we are together, we can work together, which I think could be a key inroad to building unions in the future in some of these low-wage industries.
Let's get to our callers now. We've got Rachel with us first in Eau Claire. Rachel, hi.
Hi. Yes, I was just calling in to make a comment about the discussion about Macy's.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Eau Claire, and I currently work now in my professional career, but when I was in college, I did work at Macy's. And one of the things that I noticed when working there was the things that I believe were built on the historical union from the Macy's in New York. There were things built into the company that we benefited from, even though we didn't have a direct union here. They very strictly adhered to the break schedule and laws. And the vacation time, even for part-time employees as well as full-time employees, vacation and sick time was quite good when I worked there in college, even more so, better than my first professional job out of college. The benefits of vacation and sick time was actually better.
Rachel, thanks for those thoughts. Interesting. What do you think about what she said, Peter, that she worked at Macy's a while ago, but that some of the work that the unions may have done on a different scale elsewhere, things like taking break times very seriously and vacation and sick time, were still there as part of the culture?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. So two of the three Macy's stores I studied were unionized. We're in New York. Right, so they were actually the original, one of them was the original location where some of the first unions were built in retail, specifically at Macy's in the 1930s and 40s. And that's absolutely true. I mean, I found also at the non-union Macy's that I studied that there were sort of knock-on effects because the firm is aware. The firm knows that there is about 10% of its national workforce is unionized, not only in New York, but also in other parts of the country, Seattle, San Francisco, and a few other spots, is aware that other workers who are in these non-unionized parts of their firm might get the idea when they see union workers doing better that they want the same thing. So there are positive knock-on effects within that particular firm. That's absolutely true. What I found at the Macy's that I studied was that although they've been unable or they've been pushed back significantly in terms of making wage gains for workers since the 90s at least, what they had definitely achieved was a lot greater security for workers. There was a whole sort of legalistic process. But even if managers wanted to dismiss somebody, they had to have due process. They had to have a paper trail. It took a while. Whereas Target, everyone was pretty much at will. Right? If you got on a manager's bad side one day or made one mistake, you could easily be let go with no further appeal process open to you.
Rachel, thank you so much for that call. And we're going to go next to Sam in Madison. Hi, Sam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I actually have the opposite experience of your last caller. I am recently fresh out of the retail. I actually worked in a mall at a toy store. I do miss certain aspects of it because I'm a pretty social person. But I definitely left because of all of the things that your guest was mentioning that lack from a union, the micromanaging, the shortening of breaks, the lack of accountability. It was kind of like anything goes unless you really make somebody upset. And I don't know if that's particular just to working in malls. I haven't had retail experience outside of a mall.
All right. And Sam, you're saying that this was a benefit. If there were a union there, you would have been for it.
Yeah, I would definitely think I would still be there if there was room to grow and some of those issues were resolved.
All right, Sam, thank you so much for that. And Peter, briefly, what would you say to what Sam went through?
Well, I would just definitely thank you, Sam, for contributing your experience to this discussion. I'd say that it taps into a conundrum that we're facing, that some of these jobs that have been made into bad jobs, like in retail or in fast food in America, they don't have to be that way. We could imagine other scenarios in which these are respected, qualified, well-skilled jobs. Workers are given the environment and the support that they need to do the jobs well. The customers would benefit. The firms might lose a little bit of their profits, but overall, I think the societal-wide benefit and that, especially to the workers, would be huge. And that's been achieved in other parts of the world, the developed capitalist world. Sorry, my daughter just interrupted me. One second, Elizabeth. If we look in other parts of the world, like in Germany or in Denmark or in parts of Northern Europe, where there are unions in retail stores, they've achieved living wages for workers, serious benefits, and a better work environment altogether.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was Peter Eichler, and I think one of his children, assistant professor of sociology at State University of New York College at Old Westbury, and author of the book Hard Sell, Work and Resistance in Retail Chains.
Still time to share your story. If you've worked in retail, if you do work in retail, the high points, the low points, what can make it, as he was saying at the end there, a better job for you? That's the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.